So some of the big things that they found in this report won't surprise anyone. That what they found is that if you're an African American, you're 3.7 times more likely to be arrested for a marijuana charge than if you are white. The interesting thing about the ACLU's data, however, is that there's some caveats around both the white number the white numbers because of how federal databases collect data as it relates to ethnicity of prisoners. So, for example, the white population, there's a caveat around the numbers because you may know that the federal government doesn't actually recognize Hispanic as a racial category. And so many Hispanics that end up in our criminal justice system end up being coded as white. And so when I thought about that, I thought, man, that means that we really don't know how deep the disparity really is in sentencing between white Americans that are non-Hispanic and African Americans in our population. Because, again, the numbers are based on a count that we think includes a large number of Latino population, but there's actually no way to prove it as of yet. So some of the big things that this report found was that, who knew this, that there's actually been a rise in the number of people who've been arrested simply for possession of marijuana across the country. In fact, between 2001 and 2010 alone, there were over 8 million marijuana arrests, and more than 7 million of those were for marijuana possession alone. There were 100,000 more marijuana possession arrests in 2010 than in 2001, which translates to an 18% increase in marijuana arrests between 2001 and 2010. And so we've got to ask the question, well, why would that be at a time when many states, two states have already legalized marijuana and many other states are looking at legalizing marijuana? Why would states be on this massive increase of incarcerating people for the use of marijuana? That's one question I will ask Mr. Edwards when he comes on. The report certainly gives some reasons for why that is. One thing that might surprise you, maybe not, if you had been paying attention to New York Stop and Frisk, New York State actually has the highest number of arrests for marijuana possession dating from 2010. In fact, they had an increase of 103,698% of the people who were arrested for mere marijuana possession alone. And in fact, nearly half of our states, over 90% of the marijuana arrests were for simple possession. I have a caller on the line, so we're going to go to the phone line. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give me a call at 503-231-8187. Good morning, Joanne. Welcome to KBOO.
Hello. I don't know, it was the 1990s or after. I got my medical marijuana card with a lot of... I gave up on it and didn't renew because I couldn't get buy it from anybody.
Right.
And so once in a while in my public housing, in my hallway, and I would smell marijuana, and that's what was okay with me. But anyways, that stopped too. So anyway, I realize your focus, but on Democracy Now! There was a minister that said, silence is betrayal. Okay, I'm looking for a support group where I and others can talk about problems in our public housing, even though we realize we will not get help and support for them. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. You need to take over your tenant council. That's what you need to do, Joanne. And if you want me to call you and tell you how to make that happen, leave your phone number with my fabulous engineer, Steve. Back to the conversation, one thing that surprised me in this study was that Oregon is on the list of states with the highest percentage of marijuana possession arrests. In 2010, Oregon had 9,849 people arrested for marijuana possession, out of a total of 18,047 people who were arrested for all drug offenses. That means marijuana arrests were up in Oregon by 54.6% in 2010 from 2001. So 54.6% of all drug arrests in Oregon were for marijuana possession. So is that a really good use of law enforcement dollars, incarceration, building prisons? We will have that conversation. It's interesting that our arrest rate went from, actually the study shows that we are number five in the country in the last 10 years in marijuana arrests. It puts us behind Montana, Delaware, Nevada, and D.C. And Oregon is right under D.C. when it comes to the number, the percentage of change in the arrests. And so we've actually increased our arrest rate for marijuana between 2001 and 2010 by 61.5%. That's huge. It's huge. I was unaware until I read this study that Oregon was headed down this path. And so a question, again, since Oregonians will be voting, I believe, this fall on whether or not to legalize marijuana following Colorado and Washington State in their efforts during the last election season. So we will continue that conversation. If you want to join the conversation, feel free to give me a call at 503-231-8187. One of the major findings in this study was that there was significant racial disparities across various counties. So it really didn't matter what part of the country you were looking at. When you looked at strictly arrest records, what you found was that the arrest rate for blacks were at least 3.73 times higher than for white. So what does that mean? So for every 100,000 people in the community, 192 white people were arrested for marijuana use. If you take a same 100,000, 716 black people were arrested for marijuana possession. And so that is a rate that's almost four times the rate of white arrests. And the study points out very clearly that the usage of marijuana is consistent across the board within 2 percentage points. So it's not that the African American community is using marijuana at a rate significantly higher than the white population. Is they are targeted more specifically by law enforcement, which is of course the first door into our criminal injustice system. I'm going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Garrett. Welcome to Cable. Hello, Garrett. Are you there?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Sorry. Even if Oregon were to legalize marijuana for recreational use, you would still be discriminated at the workplace, especially if you have a commercial driver's license.
Yes.
You can have that taken away for failing a drug test for smoking marijuana.
That's absolutely true. And so it's not just enough to do the legalization, right? I'm not sure what states, and I guess we'll have to look at what Colorado and Washington State does. I know Washington State pretty quickly started decriminalizing marijuana. Go ahead.
I really think that what we should add into a recreational marijuana law is that employers, or basically everyone except the state, should be banned from testing for marijuana unless you're a parent trying to test your child. If we could add that into the law, we might be able to get a little better protection against discrimination for people who are just, you know, wanting to do what they want to do in their own time, off of, you know, off the work clock.
Right. I think that you raised some valid points. I certainly know that Washington State has some new testing, quote unquote, that law enforcement do on the street to determine what is impairing the driver. I think we have to do a lot of things other than just change the law. But I don't know if I'm with you about just no testing. I think, I don't know. I'm sorry?
I don't think an employer should be able to test for to see what you've done 28 days ago.
No, I agree with you there. I certainly agree with that. But, you know, if you're a pilot, you know, I don't know, is it in your system for more than 24 hours? I don't know the answer to that.
It is. It's tested up to a month.
Up to a month, ah.
Especially if you're a big guy like me, it stays in your fatty tissue, and all it takes is a really good workout, and you might actually show a little bit more in your system than, you know, just an hour before.
Wow. So I guess the more we learn, the more hopefully laws will adapt. And I appreciate you calling in and
Thank
raising
you.
That point, because that is a very important point. Thank you.
Bye.
Have a good day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. I think it's important to have this conversation, especially before we get into campaign season, where people will be trying to push one viewpoint or another, to just look at what are we doing today. And what we're doing today clearly is not working, because what we're doing today is incarcerating a significant population that is nonviolent, and we're building prisons and we're holding people for long periods of time unnecessarily, I think. And that will be the conversation we will continue to have. It's really interesting when you think about in different parts of the country, I would have assumed that the arrest rates would have been more severe, say, in southern states. But I was actually surprised to find out that Alaska, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Kentucky are all states with huge disparities in sentencing, significant disparities, like a 384% increase in Alaska, for example, 231% increase in the racial disparity in sentencing on marijuana possession charges in these states. That's huge. And why? Why is that the case? I think it's because crime is down nationwide and police officers are looking for things to do. And so when you're looking for things to do, you go to places where people have no power and you try to exert yourself in those places. Many of the people interviewed for these reports talked about not giving police permission to search them, yet they were searched, they were handcuffed and searched anyway. And after marijuana was found, then they were arrested and charged. And so we have many issues to unpack around this particular topic of who gets arrested, why, and then who ultimately ends up going to prison for marijuana possession. To join the conversation, you can give me a call at 503-231-8187. That's the number to call. The states with the highest number of blacks arrested for possession of marijuana was Nebraska, at the top of the list, Illinois, D.C., and Iowa, which are not, other than Illinois, not states that are well known for high numbers of African-American populations. However, the arrest rates are pretty shocking. We're going to go back to the phone line, I do believe, in just a minute. And some of the report information is really broken down by various counties. It's broken down by age. And so the report is really, really helpful to actually see how this policy, how these public policy decisions have been pushed out into communities and what the short-term as well as long-term implications of them are. For example, one of the gentlemen who was interviewed for this report talked about first being arrested after being stopped walking down the street by two plainclothes detectives that said he jaywalked. When asked if they could search him, he said no, but they handcuffed him and searched him anyway, found a small amount of marijuana, and then arrested him. That arrest meant that he was then sentenced to 30 days in jail, which means he lost his job, he lost his apartment, he lost the credit for the college courses that he was in at the time, so had to drop out of that. But more importantly, he lost his driver's license, which in the community that he lives in, there basically is not a lot of public transportation. So he talks about being a single parent of an 8-year-old son who now can't get a job because of the marijuana conviction, can't get his driver's license back because he hasn't made enough money to pay off the court fines that came because of the marijuana conviction. And yet he is supposed to get a job and be able to take care of his son, yet he cannot get a job because he can't get transportation to a job that will pay him a living wage. And so this situation that I've just described has been repeated over and over and over again across the country. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, Brian. Welcome to K-Boot.
Yeah, hi, Joanne. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, listen, you know, I don't think it matters at this point, you know, who agrees and who disagrees with marijuana being legalized.
Mm.
And, you know, because it's probably a done deal. You know, Oregon's probably going to be a little slow with it. I frankly, you know, disagree with, you know, just recreational marijuana. But that's not the point.
Right.
The point is, you know, it's disturbing how many times that we hear how black people are being targeted.
Yes.
You know, and people of color, period.
Yes.
But, you know, the problem is it's not marijuana. I mean, it is not marijuana.
No, it's the police.
It's the police.
Yeah.
And, you know, it keeps coming back to,
That's right. So
we're going to use the law to control people.
Yes.
So what, you know, my question is this is, unfortunately, this huge issue
right.
is, yes, we need marijuana reform, definitely. But we also underline it's not going to fix the police problem.
No.
And the police are going to find something else to target a black person, a 19-year-old kid in college. They're going to find something else. And, I mean, you know, I'm giving you a lecture, Joanna. But, you know that and I know that. But, I mean, I have a bigger problem. You know, even though I don't like marijuana as a recreational thing, I don't really think it's a good idea in the long run. That's not the argument now. The argument is it's not the cup, it's the water.
Yes. And it's really frustrating when you think, I mean, I had no idea that Oregon's data was so bad that we would have actually even made the national list, right? That we actually have increased the number of people that we're incarcerating by 54%, African Americans that we're incarcerating by a rate of 54% in less than a decade.
And a show you did a couple weeks back with the lady about the report on racism in Oregon at PSU.
Yes.
Or the racism in Portland.
Right.
You know, I mean, I'm with Portland. I'm glad I'm here. I've been here 5 years. You know, I escaped here from Phoenix. It was getting pretty scary down there for a liberal-minded person. You know, and at some points it became too confrontive for me.
Right.
You know, physically, I felt sometimes physically in danger. You know, and I'm not a paranoid person, but you know, the point is you know, we need in Portland, all of us, and I'll include myself, is we need to wake up and look at ourselves very closely, and you know, both, and you know, especially the white population in Portland, and we're going to have to stand up and really say, look, we got to quit talking about it and start living it.
Yes, I so agree with that, because it gets really old sitting in conversations. I was just in a conversation last night that the Community Police Relations Committee of the Human Rights Commission had at Miracles Club, and listening to police officers say, we want to build relationships with the community. There's maybe three or four community members there other than myself. And I was like, you know, we can't start this conversation in the middle. You can't walk into a community that's been harmed by police actions and not address the harm that's been done.
And you know, the point is you can't build relationships with people with a billy club.
Right.
Or a taser. You
right.
know, that's not, and I don't think, I honestly don't think the police in all over America realize that you know, being threatening and having, you know, tasers and billy clubs and guns are that's not the way to initiate a relationship or searching people, you know.
Right.
I mean, when somebody searches me, I'm kind of like, well, you know, I think the idea of conversation is over.
exactly
know?
Right.
But we're not going to talk about, you know, the timbers.
Well, I mean, but I, quite frankly, I think what it is we have police, crime is down across the board. And so police forces across the country are justifying their bloated budgets. And so how do you justify bloated budgets? Well, you create the fear of crime. You create the fear of communities. And as long as you can stir people up and keep them fearful of each other, then they don't talk to each other and get to know each other and don't know their neighbors. And so, the police do a fabulous job of creating fear in local communities. That's why they have a public information office that all day sends out press release telling people how bad certain areas of town are. And we as the public have become very lazy. We just take it as fact because a police officer said it. Well, why? Why do we take that as fact when what we know is that crime is not rampant? We have police officers all dressed as if they're headed to a riot, pretty much. So how do you build relationships with people when you're armed from head to toe? It's like, I'm not going to stand and chit-chat with somebody who's that armed. And so if you're really about building relationships, you go about it differently than being than acting like the enforcer that you have become in various neighborhoods. And this report from the ACLU clearly shows that it's not just a Portland problem. It's definitely a national problem. But what we can learn from Portland is that that we're still doing it wrong, and we haven't acknowledged that we have a system that's broken that must be fixed.
And you know what, Joanne, one more comment before I'll get off the air and leave some room. But, you know, the point is I work downtown, mm-hmm. and I'm a caregiver, so I'm in and out of these buildings, and I'm riding my bike everywhere. And the last few weeks, watching the police, you know, messing with these homeless people, you know, and arresting them and making them walk lines out in the middle of the sidewalk. And I witnessed one policeman giving a guy in an electric wheelchair a ticket for what? I mean, I just can't imagine. I mean, wow. You know, we can all create scenarios, and I'm sure he felt justified. But, you know, the point is to see these well-armed,
yes,
well-armored men giving tickets and you know, basically just running these home poor, sleep deprived, and a lot of times inebriated homeless people through the mill.
Yes.
It amounts, as a passing by, it amounts to nothing but watching a schoolyard bully
right.
pick on a very weak, sickly person.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I brought up this COP program, the Chronic Offender Pilot Project, that's part of the Prosper Portland initiative that came out of Police Chief Mike Reese's office. I brought this up last night. The police in the room were they said, oh, that we don't have that program. That's not happening. The chief would never criminalize being homeless. The chief doesn't want to do that. And I'm like, excuse me? This is his program. Yeah. Oh, no, no, you misunderstand. You need to have a conversation with somebody else because that's not the program. I said, you know, I don't read it. I don't believe everything I read in the media. However, when three different media outlets report the exact same program and how it works, I tend to believe that. Well, now, amazingly, we've got assistant chiefs in the room. We got management in the room, and none of them had heard of this program. I was misinformed.
Well, Joanne, you know, just go back to the 80s and Newt Gingrich and the cultural lies that was created among the right wing, and you'll see it's permeating all facets of our government. But the police force, they're armed, so I'll let you go.
Yeah, armed by us.
Thank you
so much. Appreciate the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. So we're talking about the national marijuana policy. Who goes to jail for possession? Is there a disparity in sentencing? No question. This has been really a fascinating report. And again, the report is available on both Voices from the Edge website as well as Voices from the Edge Facebook page. You can feel free to follow along. One of the things that really surprised me in this report was it talked about even breaking out who sentenced by economics. So whether or not they are low income, middle income, or high income, the arrest rates appear to be the same. So I'm going to invite to join me now on the program Mr. Ezekiel Edwards, who is with the ACLU National Office. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
It is definitely my pleasure. So I've been whipping through your report, Marijuana in Black and White, and there's some really shocking information. I've already teased people with the knowledge that Oregon is actually on the list of states that from 2001 to 2010 saw a significant increase in the numbers of people who were arrested for mere marijuana possession charges.
This was the first report that it was a national report that looked at all 50 states and their respective counties. And while we expected to find some disparities in a few places, and we already knew, for instance, that there were significant disparities in New York City, what we were really stunned by was the extent of the disparity, that we really found it everywhere that we looked. We found it in all corners of the country. We found it, in counties, really regardless of the demographic, whether it was 2% black or 50% black, whether it was, as you had just mentioned, a wealthy county, a middle-class or poor county. Right. We found it in urban and in rural settings. And so we were really struck by, while on the one hand, marijuana policy has kind of slowly and now increasingly liberalized, that you still had a number of people, almost a million in 2010, getting arrested for marijuana,
right.
and racial disparities really throughout the country.
And I think most people understand the disparities in New York, right, with the stop and frisk. People were very familiar with why New York had such a high disparity rate. Any analysis on why this disparity rate is across the board?
Well, again, so you highlight something which goes to really what we found most shocking, because people are familiar with that in New York, but we found that, for instance, in Iowa, in Illinois, and in Minnesota, blacks were 8 times as likely to be arrested, right? They were almost, they're 8 times as likely in Washington, D.C., in Kentucky and Wisconsin, 6 times, Pennsylvania, 5 times. And then we looked at counties, and we found Sarasota, Florida, they were 10 times as likely to be arrested, in Miami, 5 times. And so you found that this was not a problem, first of all, confined to New York,
right.
And it really wasn't a problem only confined to stop and frisk. Now, I do think that it highlighted that around the country, regardless of the specific tactic that police are using, that there was a general enforcement practice to go into lower-income communities, particularly communities of color, stop and arrest people for minor offenses at rates far higher than in white communities, whether they're poorer white communities or wealthier white communities. And so there was a kind of selective enforcement of low-level offenses, in this case, marijuana possession, which we know blacks and whites use at comparable rates.
Right.
And that seemed to be something that was a problem around the country, and not just in urban settings, in suburban and rural settings as well.
And so the study went through 2010. Are you now collecting data for an update?
So, yeah, the reason it went through 2010 is that's the data that was most recently available when we came out with the study, because there's a lag time in FBI arrest data. We are certainly we're not planning on doing a follow-up study, but we're certainly looking at arrest numbers each year at the national and state level to see what's happening. And I think there are a couple things to say. You know, on the one hand, the trend right now with marijuana liberalization, and that includes obviously legalization in Colorado and Washington,
right.
Decriminalization in a number of places. Washington, D.C. just decriminalized. They had a huge problem with marijuana arrests. Maryland is looking to decriminalize. You've got medical marijuana, which can impact this as well in a number of states. I think you're going to see marijuana arrests start to, and in fact they have, decrease.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are still hundreds of thousands of people arrested for marijuana, disproportionately people of color. So we have by no means solved that problem, but I think we are at a tipping point, certainly on marijuana policy, where you will see fewer and fewer arrests for marijuana possession as people realize that it's not only racially biased how it's enforced, it does nothing to stop marijuana use and production, and it just kind of needlessly ensnares people in a criminal justice system at costs that could be much better spent on fighting real crime, on infrastructure, and other ways that I think we'll see Washington and Colorado, kind of move forward on now. So we're seeing you're going to see fewer arrests, but the problem isn't solved. And also, even in the arrests that are being made, we still continue to see racial disparities. And we see that even in places that have decriminalized.
Right.
The arrests go down, but the racial disparities of those arrests and of other low-level arrests is still quite stark.
It still goes up. And I wanted to have you talk about a point that was mentioned in the report, which is we're really unclear about the number of Latinos who are arrested and convicted because of the federal reporting system of how they're classified. Mm-hmm. Would you talk a little bit about that, please?
Sure. So the data that we rely on is data that police departments send to the FBI, and the FBI puts together in a uniform crime report. And the way that the FBI and the federal government kind of sorts that data, it really classifies people as white and black. And so what largely happens is white arrests, or I should say Latino arrests, are usually converted into white arrests. And so first of all, that inflates the number of white arrests. So
right.
We actually believe that the disparities that we report, which are quite stark, are actually worse in
yes.
the real world.
Yes.
And what it also does, as you said, is obscures our ability to know what are the arrest rates of Latinos, Hispanics
right.
around the country for marijuana possession.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at when we've been able to look at some of that data, it's a mixed bag. So in New York, Latinos are arrested at a far greater rate than whites for let's say, marijuana possession and other low-level offenses. They're also stopped and frisked, as you mentioned, at a much higher rate. In California, it looks like they're arrested at a greater rate than whites, but not as stark as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is we're not able to tease out that data right now. I flagged that as a problem, and we hope that the federal government tries to remedy that, because the only thing you can do right now is go after individual police departments' data, which is a laborious process, analyze it, and then see if you can tease out that specific data point. I think it's a problem we want to look at. And there also, by the way, you know, if you were looking at certain states, you'd want to know, maybe look more at Native American and their arrest rates. What is clear, I think, though, from our report and the data we have, is that the disparity that's greatest in this country by a significant amount is black versus white arrest rates for the same behavior.
Well, thank you so much. So we're talking to Ezekiel Edwards, and he's the director of the Criminal Law Reform Project of the National ACLU. We have several callers on the line, so we'd love it, Mr. Edwards, if you could take some questions.
Sure.
Okay. Who do we have? Hello, Ted. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty
fine.
Fine.
I was just calling for a couple of points. I wanted to mention the program on the TV here a few weeks back about the program in Philadelphia where they're actually giving people housing to get them off the street, and they found that the savings in the hospital bills and the arrest rates and the jail time and stuff actually save money over the long term, and I'm just wondering if there's any prospects for that moving into the Portland area. The second point is, I don't think it's going to matter at all what you do with trying to control these administrations of these police authorities through any kind of legislative or ordinances or any kind of oversight prospects, because you've got people like Sheriff Apayo down in Arizona, and you've got Mike Reese here in Portland. These guys have proven and admitted to the fact that they will lie to the public, they will do selective enforcement, and they will do whatever they have to make their point, and they don't care what the politicians say, and they don't care what the public says. And I would like to know how we're going to get these guys out of these positions across the board here and make sure that we've got clean police authority in force.
Well, you asked two very good questions. I will tackle the first one, since it was a Portland-specific question, which is the idea of actually moving people into housing. Housing, support services. We have a lot of elected officials who have responsibility for making that happen, that say that that is what they're doing. At the same time that we have a police department developing new programs like Prosper Portland that target houseless people for arrest. So we as Portlanders have to take back our police department and fix it and get rid of the chief that we have now.
Absolutely.
So I will let my guest, Mr. Edwards, answer the other part of the question about Arizona and other locations.
Well, first, on the you know, resource question, I think there are various programs, not nearly enough, in my opinion, that are trying to look at ways to divert people away from the criminal justice system. So, for instance, in Seattle, there's a program called LEAD, and it's a pre-booking diversion program. So when somebody is, they are arrested, but instead of bringing them to the precinct or running them through the system for certain offenses, like, you know, drug use, prostitution, they can be diverted directly into services. Now, that still may operate in a paradigm of kind of drug prohibition that I think is really should be a thing of the past, but it's definitely a step forward. So there are some police departments with more progressive police chiefs around the country who I think understand that selective enforcement's a problem, want to end racial profiling, want to save costs, and are looking to do that. We obviously need many, many more. As for people like Sheriff Arpaio, obviously there are going to be police chiefs who are running afoul of civil rights laws it's a problem. And, you know, the ACLU has sued Sheriff Arpaio for civil rights violations and prevailed. Obviously when the ACLU sees sheriffs that are clearly violating constitutional civil rights laws, we will address that. But I do think that there are police chiefs around the country who are, you know, far more progressive and really interested in protecting communities and using resources wisely. And we hope that our marijuana report, you know, it wasn't just to chastise police, although we certainly were trying to highlight clear, explicit, and implicit racial bias, but it was also to propose ways forward, more transparency, better training, better use of resources, and obviously around drug policy to try to end that practice.
Well, there's always going to be problems as long as there's people like Arpaio and Mike Reese in charge of these police authorities.
Well, that's
absolutely
true.
No, and that's true. So, in other words, our recommendations and our kind of collaborative work with police officers, you know, doesn't work with someone like Arpaio. With someone like Arpaio, we sue them, right? We sue them for civil rights violations. And obviously, like you said, people, residents of those states are going to have to, and those counties are going to have to take matters under their own hands through their processes to remove them. But there are other chiefs who are not Arpaio, you know, with whom we're trying to move forward in more progressive ways.
Well, thank you so much for that. We're going to go back to the phone line. Hello, David. Welcome to KBOO.
Morning.
Good morning.
A good show. I'm down in San Francisco where real estate values are going so insane that and much of this same activity is going on not only here in the city but throughout the Bay. And I'm wondering, first of all, is Oregon, do you have privatized prisons?
We do not in Oregon, no.
Okay, well, I'm wondering, I used to live in Colorado, and certain of the counties had started to privatize, and corrupt politicians would ship prisoners over to the privatized prisons and do it in such a way that if they were going to run for more of a statewide office, if, say, for example, the mayor of Denver wanted to run for governor in the next election cycle, he would send prisoners to these privatized prisons and then get political support in exchange for doing it. So, even if they're not privatized, that may be going on. Are a bunch of these homeless people getting shipped to the outstate counties, and then some of the corrupt politicians getting political favors for doing it?
Well, we had politicians create our mandatory one strike you're out law in Oregon quite a few years back, and so it's not corrupt in the way that you're describing. It's corrupt and the short-sighted get tough on crime, we're going to hold people accountable, and yet what we do is warehouse a majority of folks in prison. So it's corruption, but I think a different kind of corruption.
Well, and this is something, the second question is for your guest. He was talking about changing the statistics, fraudulently changing statistics. I was looking for the attribution on it. I still haven't found it, but someone sent me a post the other day that showed that in deaths, shooting deaths, if I remember right, the corpses were their racial identities were being changed to black, even if somebody was white or Hispanic or Chinese or whatever, they were all they were generally being changed to black, and then that was showing some statistical anomalies that blacks are always getting shot. And so this really smells of kind of that Nazi master race sort of junk, where they had a whole bunch of statistics saying that, well, it's just a good practice to round up all blacks because they're not, fit for human society or something like that. And then, of course, they gas them next. So it sounds like I'm wondering if Homeland Security is encroaching, because some of these corrupt practices, if you read the guy that wrote the book, The Manchurian Candidate, one of his earliest books was called An Infinity of Mirrors. And it describes some of this same technique that was done when the Germans invaded Paris, and just the utter corruption of the Nazis as they were rounding up people, stealing their goods. And in fact, when you start arresting blacks in large numbers down here in San Francisco, there are a number of blacks that owned their homes. And if one of their kids got arrested, it was quite likely that they would have to spend so much money on legal fees that they would end up losing their home.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. I'll give my guests an opportunity to respond.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Sure. Just first on private prisons, I just wanted to let your audience know the ACLU has done a lot of work around private prisons. We put out a report called Banking on Bondage seizing on this kind of problem of companies profiting off mass incarceration. And I would just note that, you know, private prisons for adults were virtually non-existent until the early 1980s. And between 1990 and 2009, private prisons increased by 1,600%, 1,600. And today, for-profit companies are responsible for 6% of state prisoners, which might sound small, but you have to remember how many people we have in prison,
That's right.
16% of federal prisoners, and it's going up. And in 2010, the two largest private prison companies received almost $3 billion in revenue. This is clearly a problem, and it's going to also not just be private prisons. It's going to be private probation, as some states decrease their prison populations but increase their surveillance. That's going to be often outsourced to private companies. So that's a huge problem. In terms of the collection of race data, I would just say that we're very, very confident in the reporting of black arrests in this country, because if anything, they can be underreported because
right.
police departments aren't always turning their arrest information over to the FBI. Our issue was with the fact that Latino arrests were often categorized as white arrests, so you couldn't figure out how many Latinos were arrested, and it could often inflate the white arrest number. I think that's really less a deliberate a tactic. It's more just kind of an administrative gaffe that needs to be fixed so we know what's actually happening.
Can I just disagree with you for just a sec?
Sure.
I think it's absolutely intentional. I think the intentionality is around really hiding how bad the disparity is. I don't think it's by accident that we haven't figured out over the last 2 or 3 decades how to record Hispanic inmates in a way.
Just to be clear, a number of police departments do record Latino arrest data. The problem is when they provide it to the federal government, the federal
right.
government just groups it as white, to the extent that I think that's a problem that can and should be fixed, and
right.
I hope they do that.
Well, and I hope I thought they fixed it with the last census, right? That they actually expanded race categories.
Yeah, well, the census is broader. The
right.
census is definitely broader than the arrest data. I did want to mention just for your viewers that just this week we have launched a website called...
I was just headed there.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Theuncovery.org. That's T-H-E-Z and then Uncovery, U-N-C-O-V-E-R-Y, theuncovery.org, which basically simplifies our report into very kind of searchable and usable data sets that anyone can go on, plug in your state, see what the arrest disparities are, see how much money your state sent, and then send some sort of petition, essentially, to your legislator or to a friend, kind of alerting them to this problem and asking them to end the war on marijuana. So I would encourage your viewers to go to that website.
Yeah, and it's wonderful how quickly it actually calculates how much money was spent. And how does that calculation work? I mean, because I put Oregon in and all of a sudden $50 million popped up.
So we did we have a fiscal analysis in our report. We found that the country as a whole spent over $3.6 billion in 2010 enforcing marijuana laws. That's enforcement from policing, adjudicating, and in some cases, you know, sentencing and incarcerating. The fiscal methodology is included in our report. I'd encourage people to look at it. These are estimates, but we think they're strong estimates. A lot of states have looked at them. We've talked to police chiefs. We've gotten very little pushback. I think everyone knows that when over 50% of your drug arrests in 2010 are for marijuana, and you think about all of the money that this country spends on law enforcement and on incarceration and the criminal justice system, it's not really a surprise that states are spending tens to millions to hundreds of millions of dollars just on marijuana enforcement.
Right. We have a couple of other callers. We're going to try to squeak in before the hour is up. Hello, Francis. Welcome to KBOO. Can you be short, sweet, to the point? We're almost out of time. Are you there, Francis? Hello, hello. Maybe we lost Francis. Hello, Harvey. Welcome to KBOO. Can you be short, sweet, and to the point, please? Harvey? Well, I guess we will give Mr. Edwards the last opportunity then, since we seem to have lost some of our callers. Hopefully they'll call back. And so the Uncovery tool is a great tool for anybody to be able to use to send a message to their state legislators or federal congressional delegate to basically say, we need to fix this law.
Yeah, it's really to alert people about the report, have them look at what their state is doing in terms of marijuana enforcement, and urge them to change their practices and move forward in a different direction, the way that Colorado and Washington have, the way that cities are starting to do as well as they decriminalize. I think the two points I would just like to end on is, mm-hmm. is one, while this is about marijuana, it's important, and we talk about this in the report, that this is happening in the context of a larger war on drugs.
Right.
Has gotten a lot of attention now. It's been, 40 years, 40 million arrests, $1 trillion, and it's failed.
Right.
And it's time. We can solve the marijuana problem, and I think we need to, but we have to take, I think, a much different and more public health-oriented approach to drug use and drug abuse. Portugal has done that. Uruguay is doing that. Obviously, Colorado and Washington, when it comes to marijuana, I think we need to do that in a really bold and broad way. And I'd also say that you can also deal with the drug war, and that will have a significant, I think, ameliorative effect on racially biased policing, but you're still going to have problems with racial bias and selective enforcement outside of the drug war context, and we hope that this report shines a light on the need to kind of improve practices in that regard.
Well, thank you so much. I think it's a very well done, very well researched report. It
thank
certainly
you.
Has facts that we can use at the local level to help improve policy. And here in Oregon, as we prepare for ballot measures that will be on our November ballot to legalize marijuana, I want to make sure that we're having the conversation about and what changes have to take place in other parts of our justice system to ensure that that we are protecting people's rights. And that's a big one, because clearly we've done a very poor job of it so far. But I think the more we bring this information to light, the more opportunity people have to have an impact on making it better. And so, Mr. Edwards, I want to thank you once again for joining us for the program. I have put your report on both the KBOO website as well as on the Voices from the Edge Facebook page. So I'm looking forward to having more dialogue and more conversation. And thank you, ACLU, for what you do.
Well, thank you for having me. Good luck with legalization, and hopefully the fact that in 2010, Oregon, 54% of its drug arrests were for marijuana, that will change.
Yeah, I'm going to make sure that our legislators know that that is what we did in 2010. Hopefully we can do better as we
Sounds
move
good.
Forward. Thank you.
Thank
Have
you.
A great day.
You too.
Okay, Mr. Edwards is gone. That was Ezekiel Edwards, who is the policy director with the National ACLU. We'll be back next week, same time, same place, same station. Hope you have a great day. Thank you.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Sky. Take away everything and make everybody feel high.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock. Good morning. You are listening to the Mighty Boo KBOO Portland. Coming up on their Thursday morning at 9:30, in about a half hour, we'll hear a special live broadcast of KBOO's Persian Hour as Iranians celebrate Nowruz, the Persian New Year, in Portland at the exact time of the spring equinox. At 10:30, we'll hear a shortened edition of Flashpoints featuring an interview with noted Israeli author and activist Ilan Pape. At 11, on Between the Covers, host Jay Thiemeyer interviews local author Willie Vlotten about his new novel, The Free, which follows the story of a brain-damaged Iraq war vet who lives in a group home. And at 11:30 on the radio zine, Ren Green speaks with Joan Foley of Headland Community Radio in Port Hedland, Western Australia, about her all-volunteer station, her childhood radio experiences, and why community radio is especially important in Australia. That's all coming up this morning, but first it's Teresa Mitchell hosting Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. That's coming up next on KBOO.
Last year, the Oregon legislature passed a bill to reduce the size and cost of our state prison system. The bill flatlined prison growth, reduced sentences, and extended transitional leave. The money saved from these reforms was reinvested in Oregon counties for programs and services to help reduce prison intakes, protect the public, and lower recidivism. Tune in to Prison Pipeline to hear how Washington County plans to spend its justice reinvestment funds. That's Prison Pipeline, March 24th at 6:30 p.m.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Bear Witness, a storytelling night to celebrate the release of Extra Tough No. 6.75, report from Uyak Bay, Thursday, March 20th, 7 p.m. at the Jack London Bar, 529 Southwest 4th Avenue in Portland. Bear Witness features Vanessa Rennick, Laura Messersmith-Glavin, Mo Baustern, Judith Arcana, and Tim Griffey. Again, that's Thursday, March 20th at 7 p.m. at the Jack London Bar. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO would like you to grin and bear it. It's a bear variety show. Bears on film, bears in songs, dub bears, queer bears, dancing bears, bear improv, bear comedy, bear fitness tips. I can barely stand it. And here are the bear facts. It's Friday, March 21st from 7 to 9:30 at the IPRC, 1001 Southeast Division Street. That's Friday, March 21st from 7 to 9:30. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Every teddy bear who's been good is sure of a treat today. There's lots of marvelous things to eat and wonderful games to play.
This is Press Watch, our weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know, giving you the tools to destroy billionaire rule. Hi there. I'll bet someone has guessed by now that I was a little late coming into the station. Yeah, you know, that happens sometimes. From time to time. And now I'm waiting for my script to appear. All these details are doubtless fascinating. The latest from Crimea, of course, is that people are marching around in little circles, flipping off President Obama. Okay, I'm making that up. But actually, I'm saying that because, you know, I really don't care if the Russians are defiant. What I care about is whether the U.S. will provoke some sort of conflict or risk a conflict. And I find that really, really irritating. I remember when I first got into radio, I worked at a radio station in Lubbock, Texas. And in Lubbock, well, you know, that was one of the more amusing things to do, that and take college classes. And there was, I remember, a packet that was not to be opened, a packet that was to be opened only in case of nuclear war. This is present in all radio stations. This is 1982, I think. And the Reagan administration was in office, and they were provoking the Russians. And they were provoking the Russians in the Black Sea, come to think of it. And I remember that at some point, U.S. sailors were lining up on the sides of their destroyers, battleships, whatever, and actually flipping off Russians and mooning them and this sort of thing. And this was during, of course, the USSR-U.S. Cold War. And the idea was that they would intimidate the Russians. And if they were risking thermonuclear war, then, well, what the hell? I mean, who cares about the little folk? This is what I hated about Reagan. One of the things, I guess, I mean, he had 110 indicted appointees. People think that Reagan was a great president. It depends on what you think he was great in, I suppose. But that was one of the things I really just couldn't stand, is that he would risk nuclear war just to bully the Russians. And actually, if you look it up, you can actually find a video on YouTube taken from a Russian ship that shows